How are you most alike, your main character, Maeve?
Maeve came to me because I was ill in 2007. I had been doing a lot in my life. I was newly divorced, raising two children, teaching full-time at a university, and promoting a book. And guess what? I called it my overdue notice from God. I got very sick with Crohn's disease. I was diagnosed, and that was my second autoimmune disease. So I really had to change my life. When something like that happens, it's as though your instructions for living just got torn up, and you have to get a whole new set. And so I'm closer to Maeve probably than any protagonist that I've written. I always say that writer's work is emotionally autobiographical, so you might not be able to see any similarities in life story, but the similarities in life story are there for me. I was looking for a book that would keep me company in this dark time. I find a lot of things absurd. In this situation, there was a lot that I just thought was desperately funny, and I couldn't find a book that addressed that issue, so I thought, okay, I'm going to write this one.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Catherine Trueblood about her novel, Take Daily as Needed. The first half of the interview contains some adult language and material. Listener discretion is advised. This interview was made possible with the generous support of the Montana Book Festival. Catherine, I think it's best if we just launch into the book. Will you read a bit of a chapter for us?
Certainly. So I will read from the title story, Take Daily as Needed. I think we've had enough preface, so I'm just going to jump in. So this is Maeve, and she's the one who narrates the book. In the garage, I find four varieties of wasp doom: total kill, home defense, spectracide, and real kill, all of them bought by my ex-husband and of unknown quantity and potency. I line them up behind me on the driveway like a mini brigade, fullest to least full, each guaranteeing a powerful foam spray and rapid termination, but none specifying how to get the contents inside the nest. I don't suppose that this is what a woman a week out of the hospital should be doing. But the overgrown lawn can't be dealt with until the wasps are dealt with, and it beats opening mail that details which procedures were covered by insurance and by what percentage. My plan is to rip open the nest with the stick and then blast the little f***ers. The nest looks like a beat-up gray soccer ball and reminds me of the pictures of a self-sealed tumor that a cancer survivor once showed me. Whenever I want to cheer myself up, I say to myself, at least you didn't get cancer. Only vague autoimmune diseases such as lupus or Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, incurable but manageable. The doctors seem to have settled on Crohn's as my diagnosis. If you want to clear a room, all you have to do is say, inflammatory bowel disease. When I told my son Norman the term, he said, sounds like flames are going to shoot out of your ass, Mom. Not surprising. When the psychiatrist told Norman he had Asperger's at age 11, he said, oh, great. Now I've got an Asperger. Just what I need. And he refused to go back. I try my son on his cell phone one more time. Norman is fast on his feet, a top midfielder on the high school soccer team. His laconic, hey, almost makes me believe he has answered. Hey, I'll check my messages probably weeks after you call, and if you've said something witty, I'll call back. What? Am I supposed to appreciate his candor or call him an arrogant little punk ass? I tear at the wasp's nest with abrupt vengeance, dropping the stick and ducking my head as I send the foam spray toward the wasps, which look like agitated jelly beans. A few fly at me and hover about the trap door, trying to return to the colony, and I zap these too. The chant in my brain hisses its own stream of invective. Die, you little f***ers, die! The cloud that roils over my head smells like industrial solvent and Jean Nate eau de toilette. I run from the toxic, lemony mist, pulling the garage doors down with a strength I didn't know I had. Holding myself against the washing machine, I allow myself to cry for about 1 minute. Because who could you ask to do this favor? Who? And I myself am so full of chemicals. Chemicals that weaken me. Chemicals that sustain me.
About the book, Ashley Shelby notes, never a false note, never a line of dialogue that didn't feel heartbreakingly real. The work seems to open a seam in the experience of parenting that has never been pulled open before. And Catherine, I'm not a parent, but this had me diving down, you know, the spiral of parenting in such a real and compelling way. And I wanted to know, why steer us into that, you know, hornet's nest rather than escape us from it?
I think that there's a lot of serious fiction out there by women, serious literary fiction by women. And that includes having political content as well, because this has much larger ramifications. The American family is very medicated. Women are being told that if we just get the balance right, we can juggle everything. You know, it's always about that work-life balance thing. And I think we're really being sold a bill of goods because it's overwhelming and it's impossible to try to do all these things at once, especially without the support that was dreamed of in the 70s by women feminists. We were going to have state-supported childcare. We were going to have, you know, job share and flex time and all these other things that didn't happen. You know, the escapist part of it becomes chick lit, right? And I find it that it's hard to carve out the room for serious literary fiction writers in the U.S. A lot of us kind of get swept into the chick lit pile, right? I've even had that response once from an editor. He goes, well, we just did a chick lit thing last week. Okay, all women's fiction is not chick lit. It's fine if you want escapism, but many of us don't, and we're looking for something that is reflecting our lives back to us and wrestling with the seriousness of not having the support, not having the equality in the social contract.
To me, that's a fascinating choice not to write it in memoir then, is to keep it in the fiction form, because it allows us entry into other lives, and there's so much humor and irreverence in the book too.
Yeah, I call that survival humor. Humor is a human gift that we have that allows us to cope. And it was very important to me. I thought when I first was writing it, I had to kind of go over some internal resistance about that, because I thought, you know, we have this idea that the person who's sick is noble and they're supposed to portray certain things that we find reassuring, right? There's a whole master narrative about illness. We're supposed to find the thing that makes us better. It's almost marketplace oriented, right? You take this pill, you get better, and then you're thankful that you were ill because it allowed you so much insight. I really think that's a crock. You know, we find meaning in illness because we have to, right? Mm-hmm. That's cognition. That's reflection. But I'm not grateful I got my illness. I'm not going to go there. So the humor is very important. And I think in any group of people, I find that, you know, I work in the community of veterans as well as a writing teacher. You just find a lot of gallows humor. And I was raised with it. So I don't think there's any way I could be without it.
Mm-hmm. As I was reading the book, I thought, oh, this is what we take daily as needed. We take the medicine of humor. Mm-hmm. But I heard you speaking very, very clearly about being sold a bill of goods. And I want to know, what has allowed you then to push back against that sense of consumerism and that capitalist approach to your illness?
That's a really interesting question. I was fortunate because I was able to take a medical leave when I got sick. Not a lot of people have that option. When I was sick, I became aware of a lot of other parents who were ill, and also a lot of children who were living with parents who were, whether they were ill or addicted, or a world of strife. And I feel really concerned about those people. So yeah, it just connected me to a much deeper experience of illness, if you will, and how much more pervasive it is than what we see. The commodification of illness, you know, you see that on any Humira ad or Entyvio ad on television. The fact is there's a narrative in illness called the chaos narrative. And this isn't original. This is from a fellow named Arthur Frank, who wrote a book called The Wounded Storyteller. And he talks about the chaos narrative. And the chaos narrative happens when you become sick and you're worried you can't go back to work and you realize that disability is a form of poverty. If you're talking about Social Security, if you can even get it, people lose their houses and their jobs, and it's a really sickening spiral. Or people go enormously into debt and have medical debt for the rest of their lives. So I felt compelled to write about some of this.
I was thinking about Maeve's children. Her daughter, Noelle, has a pretty serious allergy, mm-hmm. and her own body rebels mm-hmm. time and time again in the book. And then her son has Asperger, you know, has an autism spectrum disorder. Mm-hmm. And so what was important to you? Well, and I guess I want to know, and are the husbands spared then of these illnesses? And what was meaningful to you about writing multiple characters with body rebellions?
The character who has anaphylaxis is actually from my own experience. My daughter has anaphylactic allergies to nuts and shellfish. And the part of that picture that I don't think people consider is that repeated trips to the emergency room, when your body, in 7 to 8 minutes, your eyes swell shut, you go into respiratory distress. It takes epinephrine to turn that around, a nebulizer to clear the lungs. In other words, that's really scary for a young child. And my daughter's solution at one point was just to quit eating, you know. So I wanted to look at the effects of trauma on children when their own bodies are not something that they can trust. And often also when people in the adult world have fed them, as in her case, someone at the childcare, that in the case of the character in the book, someone at her childcare has fed her nuts. And so that destabilizes her whole sense of trust in the world. The mother, in terms of the son, I think the mother really just wants to call her son eccentric, right? And the teachers want to medicate him. They first start out with calling him ADHD. He runs through a whole series of diagnoses in the book. And I leave that kind of vague on purpose because there's clearly so much love that the mother has for him. And she's trying to just allow him to be this kind of rich, visionary, odd person, you know, and hoping that there's still enough room in the world for that. And even questioning, because Maeve's own brother is he's a medic on a helicopter. He's a helicopter medic. And she thinks about, you know, maybe you need some ADHD to do a job like that, right? And even her own father was a surgeon, but he's OCD, right? I was like, well, which surgeon do you want? The one who triple checks everything or the one who forgets a staple? So there is a little bit of a pushback with pathologizing, and just rather than just having more acceptance for who people are.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Catherine Trueblood about her novel, Take Daily As Needed. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. One of the things I loved most, maybe, about the narrator Maeve is her resistance to this notion of domesticity and 20th century American womanhood or 21st century. Mm-hmm. And at one point you write in her voice, "I continually forget to do the wife-like thing. I don't believe in asking permission. I'm impulsive. I let children smash the gingerbread house with hammers. I bring a dog home from the shelter without asking him first. I forget to draw the curtains before pulling off my clothes. I never want to leave a party when he does. So tell me about that element of her. Why? What is the sort of the political resistance, or I might even reach to say sort of the feminist voice in Maeve?
I think that a lot of us have internalized a 1950s version of gender roles that is unexamined until you get married. Katha Pollitt talks about this, that you could marry a domestic Democrat and wind up with a domestic Republican, which I thought was a very funny idea in a way. But she is a very independent person, and when she marries her husband, you know, he is at least verbally saying, oh, I'm in for all these feminist ideals. But when it comes to the hard work of doing it, he was raised by a stay-at-home mother. And a lot of men have been raised by a stay-at-home mother. And so he has a lot of unconscious expectations of Maeve and what she should be doing. And so, you know, for much of their marriage, she tries to do that. She tries to add everything in, right? So she wants to be a paralegal. She's trying to get a community college certificate to become a paralegal and raise the children and take care of her parents. She's got two parents, both of whom have problems. Her father has a traumatic brain injury. So it's that this idea that we have that we can just keep adding everything in without there being a cost. And I think that you have to realize, you know, what you need to subtract things in order to have rest, in order to have play. And you can't be a creative person or a resilient person with your own children unless you've had some play and some rest. And so what's happening is that her marriage becomes a threat to her own health because he's unwilling to become conscious in his kind of, it's a form of sexism, really. Yeah.
I guess I am so taken by your passion about the book, but about the underlying issues. And I don't know if you can speak to this, but I want to know, is there another way than this idea of a nuclear traditional home situation and these modern pressures that we put on families, but particularly women? What do you imagine as another way?
I do think about that quite a lot. I wrote an essay called Honey, Don't Break Yourself that's forthcoming from Minerva Rising, which was my advice to younger women. I think the nuclear family is incredibly isolating and puts a lot of pressure on people. My mother was, she married three times, but the most fun was when she wasn't married, and she we lived in a neighborhood full of divorcees, scandalous divorcees, and the kids all ran around as a tribe. And you could kind of go to any mother's house and get fed or get a Band-Aid or whatever it was you needed. And I think that was a good model for me growing up. I know there's an anthropologist, I want to say her name is Helen Fisher, but she talks about the association as the new family, the idea that you choose friends and family to make a larger network. And I think that's really important because, you know, with both parents working, which is what we have, there's nobody, if there's a crisis or a trauma or an illness, there's nobody to send out in reserve into the world to do, to, you know, the workplace or to do the errands. And this is something that Elizabeth Warren, when she was at Harvard, was writing about, when she was writing about the American family, that we have no reserves anymore. So I tell young women, live in co-op housing if you can. There's a lot of co-op housing in Seattle because I think that's a great idea. Then you can cook one night a week, or two nights a week, and share it with some other people. And I think that the American dream as we know it is not sustainable. It's not sustainable ecologically. And I don't think it's sustainable emotionally or psychologically. I have, you know, my students, I've been teaching 25 years. my students at the university tell me that one of the things they are the most stressed about is that their parents expect them to achieve the American dream, and they no longer feel it is achievable. And so I think we really need some new models. Yeah, I'm excited by that. I think the family has to change.
You mentioned younger women, and I just want to hone in on Maeve's relationship with her daughter, Noelle. Mm-hmm. At one point, you write in the voice of Noelle, "You've made all my love go away." And you write these classic kid and teenage lines, and I just want to know, what's your secret to writing dialogue?
Oh, boy. I listen really carefully. You know, my journal is my sketchbook, so I'm fortunate, right? Because I'm a university professor. I hear it all around me all the time. First 10 minutes before class starts, I don't say a thing. I'm just shuffling through my papers, listening. I try to have an ear for dialogue. I didn't think I used to be good at it. And so I worked really hard at listening to people and then going back and cutting it down, letting less stand in for more was really important. I love dialect everywhere. And, you know, teenagers have their own lexicon. They really do. Wherever I am, I just try to tune into what the lexicon is of that particular group.
There's this other scene in the book when Noelle is a teenager and Maeve is attempting to warn her about a dangerous situation with a man, and Noelle gets punky and Maeve becomes aggressive. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about that mode of women in some ways having to rely on aggression to protect women from aggression.
Right.
You know, and the shame and the guilt and the confusion and the hurt around that. And I just, what can you speak to around those types of pressures as women?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that I like to put characters in ethical conflict. And that story also features Maeve's best friend, Regina, who's much more old world. She's closer to immigrant roots in America. She's Jewish. And, you know, she is the one who's saying, "So what? This is okay. You had to teach her." So I wanted to push back a little bit against some of the parenting views that we have now that are so child-centric that I think we have to be careful. This particular story is really, you know, what do you teach your daughter about rape? And what do you do if your daughter dismisses you? Right. So there's a later story that kind of pairs with this one where the mother and daughter go to a self-defense class, and the mother is aware of how much sort of PTSD is loose in the room with the women as they're doing these physical stances and having to, you know, block and hit and punch and do all these things. So while Maeve is really, what she does is she slaps her daughter because her daughter backtalks her at a moment when things are critical, when they might be in a dangerous situation. They're out hiking and they run into some fishermen and maybe these guys are just a little crusty. Maybe it's really not okay. And she doesn't know which. And what the daughter, of course, can't know about her mother is that her mother has been sexually assaulted, right? So in that moment, you know, if you're going to forgive Maeve, maybe you don't forgive Maeve. I forgive Maeve because Maeve has her own traumatic reaction to, you know, her daughter saying, right, just giving her back talk about the moment, not taking heed.
I was thinking this book felt like a manual for parenting or like the anti-manual or like somehow to contextualize for parents, this is why it's so hard.
Yeah. Yeah.
How were you really hoping readers would absorb it?
Well, in my experience, parenting takes all of your stamina, really. This notion that you settle down and have children has always amused me because the wildest ride of my life has been with my children. I find a lot of the advice about parenting to be really genteel. Also, you know, this mother does have children who are in many ways highly gifted, but also neuroatypical. I got frustrated with parenting advice. I really did very early on. I felt like my kids weren't in the index, you know? And I felt that in a way for many years that I was being taught not to trust myself. I learned a lot. I wanted to be inside the child's mind, but I didn't find something that I needed reflected there. So I really do write always for that one reader, you know, who's needs to be kept company. You know, I am that person who's for reading to save my life late at night and finding something that says, oh, this they get. They understand this. So I didn't want to shy away from the grittier, more uncomfortable sides of parenting or the ways that parenting can test you. I didn't want to see it through an orange hazy filter.
I was thinking about this sense of trusting your voice, and as a craft decision, you include Maeve's diaries. And I was wondering about that decision and what the meaning of that was for the narrator.
Well, the book does a lot with, I play with many kind of hybrid genres, so I use the language of side effects, medication side effects in one story. I use a questionnaire, basically a questionnaire to determine if your child is ADHD, the Vanderbilt questionnaires. I use that in another story. And so I'm always interested in multiple formats. But the diary, that's from the story The Horror of Healing. It's where you dip into Maeve's 1970s upbringing. She attended an alternative high school in the 70s on an island off the coast, a hippie school. You know, when you're writing memoir, you've got two voices, and one of them is the person that you were then and the person that you are now reflecting and interpreting meaning. I felt that that was such a different era. I had a friend say that to me once when I was trying to explain it to my daughter, and she said it was another era. So I thought it would be wonderful not to have to explain it. Just use the voice of that 14-year-old writing a journal while in this crazy environment. Mm-hmm.
My last question is, what is your hope for your children as they maybe are or become adults and have to sort out midlife?
Mm-hmm. Well, my motto with my children has always been 25 and alive. Which is, I know, fairly modest, right? I know a lot of parents talk about what colleges they want their kids to go to or levels of achievement that they want for their children. And I've always just really wanted my children to be emotionally healthy people. And I want them to have in their lives rest and play and creativity, as well as a way to use their gifts in the world. To make sure that their jobs are, you know, are a way to use their gifts in the world. But because I don't think the American dream is sustainable anymore, that we're really going to have to refashion it, my hopes for my children don't fit that frame.
Catherine Trueblood teaches English at Western Washington University in Bellingham, Washington. She was awarded the 2013 Goldberg Prize for Fiction and the 2011 Red Hen Press Short Story Award. Her full bio can be found at our website at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.